that's just one of the songs that always got everybody up and going when Deddy would perform it on stage. Pretty amazing. I would say that and Vekove. There were some basic staples of Deddy's live concert performance that were just done so well, even better than the recordings, and really got the crowd going. Unbelievable. I promised you we'd reminisce a bit about Deddy, who we lost at an age that we all consider too young, 62 years old. He passed away yesterday. And I don't think most people, I mean, obviously he had a lot of friends. He had plenty of friends in our Jewish music world and a lot of friends in Israel and around the world in many different walks of life. I don't think many people realize that Ding, of Suki and Ding, who's been with us on the air for 40 years, I don't think people realize how close he was with Deddy and close from a very early age. So I said to myself, I'm just going to get Ding on and reminisce a bit. We'll see which stories we'll tell, because there's some that just make me laugh every time I think about it. Ding, I'm sorry about the circumstances, but nonetheless, a pleasure to welcome you back to JM in the AM.
Thank you, and I'm very glad that you didn't call me a business associate or anything like that, but just a friend, a real friend for so many years, and we're going to miss him dearly.
Someone sent me a clip, a two-minute clip. I could forward it to you. A two-minute clip from an interview that I did with you years ago. I have no idea what year it was. And you said, Nahum, this is my favorite Deddy story. Now, I don't know if today you would say it's still your favorite Deddy story. Do you know which one it was?
No.
It was the one it was the one where his father asked you to take him to camp and,
correct,
and get him a job. And what job was the only one still available a day before?
Oh, about the waiter,
right,
one.
Right. You got him over.
That was great.
You got him a waiter job, and when the first meal of camp shows up, when everyone shows up for the first meal of camp, every table except for two are set up, ready to roll, ready to,
correct,
you know, and,
correct.
And they went over to Deddy and said,
no, the head counselor came running to me and said, because he's the one that gave that, you know, that got him the job.
Right.
So he came running to me because I was the one that vouched for him. And he says, what's going on over here? So I call over Deddy. I said, Deddy, you realize that all these kids have to go ahead and eat? And he says, so let them get up and get the food.
Right. No, the way you told the story the first time on the air, you said that, you know, you got to get the plates, you got to get the cups, you got to get the forks.
Right.
And then he said, let them get up and get it themselves.
Exactly. He goes, what do you think? I'm the slave?
I don't, but in all fairness to him, yeah, and you said this during the interview, in all fairness to him, he probably just didn't understand what waiter meant, like what the role of the waiter was in camp.
I don't know about that. I just know that the head counselor gave me this look, and he didn't like argue, and he says, okay, we'll find you another job. He ended up being the hit of the camp. I mean, everybody loved him, and the famous story is when we taught him about color war, what color war is, and we told him there's a red team and there's a blue team, and so he stayed up the whole night and he got paint. He went to town and bought red paint. He was on the red team and just started painting.
Oh, gosh. He was, he was somebody who thought independently. Let's put it that way.
100%. And he was a dreamer, He really was a dreamer. There was nothing he didn't want to, he wouldn't go after. If he had a dream, that was it.
And by the way, and this was confusing to me also, you first met him when he came to America with Pirkei Yerushalayim?
Correct. In 19, was it 75? So, what's in Meishkan? You remember Meishkan?
Sure.
Meishkan, right.
From Nagina. Meishkan from Nagina.
Nagina, right, correct. So they produced a Pirkei Yerushalayim came out, whatever, beginning of the year. It was like, Meishkan brought them in for four shows on Pesach. And at that point, I was a teenager, and I was like hanging around in the Gino office, and so he asked me to, you know, go ahead and take care of the kids when they're coming, you know, take them to Great Adventure. Great Adventure had just opened up in New Jersey. And so that's where I met him. But even as a kid, and he was 14 at that time, he was like the hit of the party. Like, in other words, he was the personality, and he would always imitate Yigal, which is hilarious.
Meaning Yigal Salik. Leader of the choir.
It's
not like he was the star soloist, and that's how you knew him.
He was just the personality within the
choir.
He wasn't a soloist. He was just always like making all the jokes and all the shtick and everything else like that.
So that summer happened, or that Pesach or Sukkot happens, and
that happened, right? And then I lost contact with him for about 2 years, and then I went to Itri in 1977, the end of 77. And sometime, like, I must have been about February of 1978, I come outside Beis Medrash one day, and I see this guy with a kippah sugah, and he's sitting, like, on the ground, like, on the steps of the yeshiva in Beis Safafa, and he looks up at me, and he goes, "Ding." And I had no idea who he was. He was 2 years older, and I said yes. And he goes, "You don't remember me?" And it's broken. He always had this cute English, you know, broken English. He goes, "Tolo zecha." Yeah, anyhow, so he says, "I need daddy." And I said, "Wow," you know. And I said, "How are you?" And he looked terrible. He looked I can't explain, like, how he just looked so sad. And I said, "Daddy, how are you? You know, happy and everything." And he tells me that his mother just passed away.
Wow.
She was killed in a car accident. And I could tell how much pain he was in. And so me and Suki, we were living there, and I said, "You know, do me a favor, Dad. Come inside the Beis Medrash." We sat down in the Beis Medrash, and we came out. We made up to meet once a week. He would come, and we would sit, and we would learn. So that was like, I guess, like the second chapter.
Right.
And then, we're going back from that zman, we're going back to the States to go to Camp Agudah of Toronto. And Daddy has been asking us for weeks that we should come to his house in Ramat Gan, where his father lived, and he wanted us to come for Shabbos. So I said, "This is a perfect opportunity. We're going down to Matzah Shabbos. We'll come for Shabbos, and then we'll go straight to the airport after Shabbos." So that's what happened. And in the middle of Shabbos, Shudas. And it was a wonderful Shabbos. I can't. Daddy's father, a lovely, lovely person, and it's doing Shabbos Shudas, and he goes, "Daddy, you know what? I forgot. Could you go across the street and tell, like, one of the neighbors to give him a message?" And it turned out that he didn't really want to give the message, but he needed to get Daddy out of the house. And so Daddy said, "Okay," and he went across the street, and then he turned to me and to Suki, and he said, "First of all, thank you for what you're doing, but you realize how bad it is, and we have to get Daddy out of here. We have to send him to America. Come up with some type of, some type of plan to get him to go, take him to camp with you."
And that was and that's where the camp story came from, the Camp Agudah in Toronto?
Right, that's how the whole camp story. That night, even before I went to the airport, I called up the people in Camp Agudah of Toronto, and that's when we said, we'll make him a waiter.
and the rest is history.
Then we went back to America, and it was like 2 days before camp started, and that's when I was recording V'chol Aminu with Mordechai Ben David. So we took Daddy to the studio because he loved music. And that's when he sang a harmony with Mordechai Ben David on Vatite Lano. So
on the album that we're going to be playing a lot this week.
Right. And you always end off the...
Yeah, always end the year with Ein Kitzvah.
Right. So Vatite Lano on that.
So when we talk about him knowing you and knowing MBD and I mean, we're talking about a long, long time. He met all these people. That's what's so confusing to me. When it's time for him to, you know, to do, like you say, to dream big and to, you know, try to fulfill his dream, you know, obviously that was to get on stage and to perform as a solo act.
This was one of his dreams. He had a lot of dreams.
No, I get it. But I'm saying, but it always sounds like that there was pushback. It always sounds like people were telling him that's not a great idea, or you're not going to succeed. And
it didn't make a difference.
No, but my point is that someone like you, and not a criticism, I'm just curious what your thought process was.
Yeah.
Someone like you, you know, seeing him and knowing what he did in Cambria, like, didn't people like yourself and others think it was worth a shot with him or not?
Well, we always loved him and we always respected him. We knew how capable he was.
Right.
That's the bottom line. Like, we knew exactly, you know, what he was. Look, I can go on forever, but the mitzvahs that person did.
There's plenty to talk about. That was the one thing I posted about him, is that his any story having to do with him has to do with chesed. Everything has to do with chesed.
Everything.
Unbelievable. But you got to solve this for me. So is it then Yossi Green who decides that, you know, this guy's worthy of a solo project, or were there others that had faith in him at that point?
No. I can't really say because I don't know the answer to that, but he had this dream that he wanted to sing, and he wanted to become a star. And so the first thing that happened was that when performers or anybody, and that's how he met Murray Uberfeld, his good friend Murray Uberfeld. Murray would, and David Bodner would come very often to Eretz Yisrael, and then he would always pick him up and take him around, and so he became friendly with Murray. And then when Mordechai and David or Avram Fried would come to do a concert, so he would pick them up at the airport, and he would take them around, and he kept on going ahead, and this is the famous thing where he kept on going ahead and asking Mordechai, let me perform, give me a song, and then finally one day Mordechai and David says, okay, B'nai Uma tonight, be there at 8 o'clock, you got your one song.
Right.
And you know the story, right?
Yeah, of course.
With the suit, right?
He ripped his suit on stage.
He ran to get his suit, and he realized he only had his bar mitzvah suit, which was his last suit that he wore. Anyways, right.
It was a very funny story, but he did make it through that night.
So then, after he did that, then came the same kind of story with Hask. I think it was year five where...
He's not in year five. I don't think he's in year five. I don't think so. I could be wrong.
Is it a five or six?
Okay.
I don't think his name was listed on the program.
Okay, that could be. Go ahead.
Right. So it's year five, and that's when he did his song, and then I didn't really, you know, that's when he was living a little bit in South Africa. He had some business in South Africa, but I don't remember. You know, that eventually, you know, went into his, you know, making Ratzah. So I'm not sure whether it was Yossi's idea or not. I think it was just Deddy's idea.
Right.
I think it was just Deddy.
And he goes to a great composer, and he composes for him some great songs.
Amazing.
And also such a variety. Yeah.
He had
tremendous versatility, and we learned that on the spot, that he was able to do all types of music.
I think the opening song was actually a Baruch Trade song. Maybe that was the second one.
Yeah. Ding is with us. We're talking about Deddy, who was taken from us at the young age of 62 yesterday. Funeral taking place today in Israel. Felt it was appropriate. Ding knows him, as you heard, as you continue to hear. Ding knew him for a very, very long time, way before he was a member of the Jewish music world. And the...
I know we don't have that much time, but there were two, like, things that always stick out of his chesed. And one was with Hask. As soon as he became, it was year 10 when he already was in a stardom and everybody loved him. So that's when he took the lead. He was the lead performer at Hask 10. And as soon as he got close to Hask and saw the kids of Hask, he fell in love with them. Right. And he felt like it was his duty, you know, to go ahead and help support Hask. And that's when he called, he himself came up, he says, I'm the ambassador of Hask. And that's when he got his friends, you know, Murray and David Bodner and Charlie Kushner and these people. And you cannot imagine how much money he raised for Hask. And what he did, he built them a brand new dining room, which is millions of dollars, a brand new swimming pool for handicap, which I think at that time was $900,000. And this is like you can't, I mean, you just can't give him enough credit for doing that.
Yeah. No question about it. I remember a funny story, speaking of Chesed, where I don't know if you were in the room that night or not, but he's on stage. I was emceeing a concert, and he's on stage, and somehow a young girl got on stage. I don't know if he asked for a kid to come up, or she was making a presentation on behalf of the organization for him. I don't remember exactly what it was. And he discovers in conversation with her on stage, she's never been to Israel. So he says, right. I'm going to make – you remember this?
No, but I do remember it. I don't remember it happening, but I remember the story. Yeah.
He says, I'm sending you to Israel.
And he
says, go backstage and speak to Aaron Teitelbaum. He's going to arrange the whole trip. And we're standing there backstage going, what? What just happened? Like, what's going on here? You know? But he always felt that if there was something he could do to enhance someone's life, he wanted to do it. And he found
that's exactly. That's the bottom line. And the second thing. Thing besides this chesed of tzedakah, and it wasn't only Hask. I mean, he did so many. I always said this. I said this for years and years. If Daddy won the lottery and he won $100 million, he wouldn't have it too long.
Right.
He would give it away to tzedakah.
Correct.
But the other thing about him in terms of chesed was he could not take it whenever he saw a sick child,
right.
And it made him so. I don't know what the word is, but he felt that he has to make this child happy.
Right.
And he not one, not ten, hundreds of times, hundred. And it wasn't just go to the hospital and, you know, and sing. It was becoming this person's friend. And I mean, the story that I think that I wrote about was one time it was Chalamoid Sukkos, and there was a teenage girl who had a tumor, and I remember she was in Doctor's Hospital, which is on the east side, and it's like it's right next to Gracie Mansion, and it's not like a famous hospital, but for this particular machla, you know, that's where she had to be, and she was going, I believe she was going Wednesday, Chalamoid, this was Sunday, and Chalamoid was Wednesday, she was going to Phoenix to have a surgery. Anyway, so I pick up Daddy at the airport, and we drive down to the hospital, and Daddy goes, how am I going to sing? I don't have any keyboard playing, nothing, you know. And we get to the hospital, and like on my mind is like I wish there was some way that I can call somebody. But it's Chalamoid Sukkos, everybody's away. There's nothing. And all of a sudden, just as we get to the hospital, it's Sunday morning. Nothing's open on Sunday morning. And we look across the street, and there's a PC Richards store, and it's open on Sunday morning at 9:20. and so then he says, like his eyes lit up. We go into the store, and sure enough, there's one of these Casios, a Yamaha.
Oh,
you know,
my
keyboard,
gosh.
Right? And we buy it, and we walk into the hospital, and like that, like I told Daddy, are they going to let us into the hospital carrying this thing? And we get up to the whatever floor it was, and the elevator opens, and Daddy's standing there, and he's holding this box with and all of a sudden, the nurse on the floor starts screaming, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy! And there was another patient there, so we actually visited two patients that day, and the one that he went for, the one that had a brain tumor, had Baruch Hashem had a brain tumor, and it was removed that Wednesday in Phoenix, but when Daddy left the and this is the famous for me at least. When Daddy, as he was leaving the room, he says, "Do me a favor, invite me to your wedding." And so then she said, Emet Hashem. And that's what happened. Years later, I think it was 4 or 5 years later, she called up, and Daddy was so hurt because he had already committed that day of the wedding. He was already committed to a job. Daddy said, what am I going to do? I wanted to come. Anyhow, Daddy found out that they were making a Sheva Brachas the next night after the wedding. And he came and he surprised him and he's sang at the Sheva Brachas.
Amazing. I love Amazing. It. Ding and, is with and, us. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, it's so sad. It really is just, it's so sad because he was too young and he was too good. He was really good.
The Prime Minister of Israel recognized the news, which is pretty amazing to show you how many people of stature and different walks of life were friends of Daddy's. And by the way, speaking of Prime Minister, there's a famous story we will not tell on the air. Famous story of him and Leah Rabin. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, you could tell that on the air. There's no reason. Of course.
So he's in first class. And by the way, I was in Ben-Gurion Airport with him at least 3 times that I remember. And he knew every person in that airport. I mean, he knew everybody in that airport.
I want to tell you one thing. You're telling me about the bed. Just listen to this. You think he knows everybody in the airport? I was with him in JFK. And you know, when you go up to the second floor, right, to board, and all of a sudden he says, one second, I see this guy, and he sees a guy, a janitor, who's cleaning the floors, and he goes to me, Ding, hold on one second, and he goes over and he starts speaking to the janitor, and the janitor has this, what do you call it, the garbage cans that they have on wheels, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right? And afterwards, I said, like, you know this guy? And he laughs and he looks at me and he goes, he's the head of security at JFK. You don't realize that the broom, the case that he has, a broom, is actually an Uzi.
No way.
Yep. He knew everybody. He knew as soon as he walked on a plane, he could tell you who the marshal was
right,
on the plane.
The air marshal, was, right.
The stories don't end.
So he's on a plane. He's in first class when Al Al had a first class.
Correct.
He's in first class, and Leah Rabin is in first class, and Daddy's with his daughter, who's about a year old, and she's screaming her head off. Right? That's so far so.
Right,
so,
and you're not supposed to have a child.
Right, you shouldn't have a baby in first class, but this is the reality. He's a big traveler, and they're not denying him and his wife the opportunity. Leah Rabin, who was not the friendliest person, as many of us know, Leah Rabin was very annoyed by the fact that she's now in first class with this baby screaming in her ear, and Daddy doesn't know what to do, and then it hits him, and he said, look, you said I could tell this on the air, so I'm going to tell him.
For sure.
He brings the baby over to Leah Rabin and says, this is my son Yitzchak, named for your husband. And she holds the baby the entire flight.
No, I don't. I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but she goes, oh, thank you, and then not another word out of her, right?
Correct. and why she never asked why he has a pink blanket, I don't know, but maybe the girl didn't have a pink blanket, who knows, but that was Daddy thinking on the spot and making someone feel good in the most unusual of circumstances, to say the least. And by the way, Ding, you'll like this one. In 2001, my late brother and I are at the final game against Seattle. Remember Yankee-Seattle?
I was there.
So I'm sitting with my brother. We're in the first row of the second level. And you know, if you remember that game, it was like, it was amazing that the Yankees won that series. And the whole place was in total simcha, right?
That's Paul O'Neill's last game or something like that?
Was that his last season?
His last season.
That could be. Yeah, I think you're right. It was his last season, yeah. Anyway, so after the game, you know how it is. Instead of heading home immediately, everyone hangs out for 5-10 minutes because, you know, you're celebrating with your other fans and, you know, you want to take it in, the whole thing. We're standing there, and all of a sudden we look down on the field. There's a guy with a yarmulke walking toward the pitcher's mound after the game.
And that's... Yep.
And my brother says to me, "Who do you think that is?" And I take a close look. I go, "That's Denny." He was on the field with Mayor Giuliani after the game.
Giuliani loved him, yeah. and would take him to all the games. But not only that, that World Series, Giuliani took Denny down to the dugout. And I said, "Denny, don't forget me. You're a good friend." He goes, "I'd love to, but I can't.
You were there for him from the beginning, but he couldn't get you to the Yankee dugout, I'll tell you." There was another good Yankee story with him, by the way. I'm on stage. This is 1996. I don't know if you remember this or not. 1996, and he is the headliner of a concert in New Jersey on the night that the Yankees win the World Series. So this is Saturday night, right? The Yankees won the 96.
Sure, I was there.
You're at that concert? So we're backstage, right? You and I are backstage. So I know, because obviously my love for the Yankees in baseball, I know that the entire crowd who made a commitment to be there and they had no problem being there are certainly, and remember, this is way before cell phones and everybody checking scores on the spot. So I know for sure that the whole crowd wants to know an update on the game, right? So I go on stage and I say something, and before intermission or whatever it was, I say, "Okay, end the four innings, no score," whatever the score actually was. And I give this update. Denny comes over to me and he says, "The next updates, please let me do."
Right.
He says, "Please let me tell people."
I remember it like yesterday. Yeah.
I said, "All right." I said, "Do you know anything about baseball? Like, do you even know the lingo?" Yeah. Don't worry. So he goes on stage, Le Dugma. He goes on stage and he says, "By the way, right now in the seventh inning, there's no score," whatever the report was. And I say to myself, "This guy just told me that he knows all the lingo and he knows exactly how to report a Yankee score," but he didn't care. It was just he knew it was important.
He knew exactly what he was doing.
It was important information for the crowd, and he was going to make sure to announce it himself.
I got to tell you, before I go, one more quick story. Could you mention New Jersey? That how did he get this relationship with Charlie Kushner? Charlie Kushner's pet charity is what's it called? The Sinai Academy,
right?
Which has regular kids and it also has special kids inside, and so that's his pet charity. And so after Denny started to become popular, he called up Denny and he said, "Denny, could he actually called me up or whatever?" So I arranged to come to Sinai. They have a beautiful auditorium, and he did this concert, and the concert was amazing. And I mean. And afterwards he came over, Charlie Kushner came over and said, "Denny, here's a check." And Denny took the check. He didn't open up the envelope. He didn't look how much money it was. In front of his face, he took the check and he ripped it up. And he goes, for these kids? And that's the chesed. That's Denny.
And just so people understand, he had a large family, certainly needed the money. And by the way, one other thing, which I said to a few people yesterday, there were, and I'm sure you were in this group. It can't just be people like me. There were people that when he was involved in certain business dealings, he would include them. And when he felt the Hakaras, it happened to me, so I know it. When he felt the Hakaras Hatov, he would call you up and say, "I just want you to know that if things succeed with this, you're going to be one of the beneficiaries." And he probably did that, knowing him, with hundreds of people.
I never. The truth is, and this is so not like me and so not like anybody. We never discussed money. We never discussed money. We never. Not only that, whatever concert we did. He goes, "Ding, if you think I should be there, I'll be there." Like the money was never an issue. It was just what he felt.
I hear it. Well, Ding, if you ever make it into the Yankee dugout, please don't forget your friend Nachum Segal.
Nachum who?
Hey, I'm going to take this opportunity. First of all, we should share simchas. It's always eerie.
Amen.
It's always eerie to me when we lose someone at the very end of the year. It's always eerie to me. I was telling this to someone yesterday that God decided almost a year ago that he would not survive the year. And that's I don't know, it always gets me when it happens right before Rosh Hashanah, but this is life. This is the way it is. The brand new year begins in 3 days. Dedi's family is obviously sitting Shiva, and our condolences to them. And Ding, we should only have a year of happiness and health together and celebrate together and always share good news together. And and these precious memories, which bring so many smiles to so many faces, because that's the type of person he was, everyone should continue to
And be. we didn't cover anything like it.
I know. I could tell another 10 stories right now. I know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But the bottom line is chesed. That was it. And he couldn't take it when he saw somebody that was having tzaras. He couldn't take it. It bothered him so much. And
unbelievable. But it's so true. It's so true. The pain of others, you know, we always use this cliche and people speak about it. The pain of others was so painful to him. The pain of others was so painful to him. We should remember that.
I think back now. It's probably because he went through so much
pain
as a child.
Maybe
it's not a nice thing to say, but his father, after his mother died, went a couple of years, and then he. I don't know if you know the story. He got engaged, and the day of the wedding, he went to take a shower. And that's where he died, in the shower. He had a heart attack in the shower. It's a terrible story, but I don't know why I said it. But I
know why you said it, because it wasn't just that he had difficult circumstances. Everything that happened to him, the story with his mother, the story, everything was so dramatic and difficult to wrap your head around, and so sudden.
And then he would walk out with the biggest smile, and like nothing affected him. But Baruch Hashem.
And nobody could toss a microphone cord like he could.
I got to tell you, the kivud of aim that his children had, and Malka, his wife, it shows you how much they knew so much of what a person he was. And
amazing.
Anyway, have a good year, Nachum. Thank you for everything, and I'll see you Thursday.
Ezrat Hashem. Thank you, Ding. Happy, healthy, sweet New Year. Yes, we'll speak Thursday and give each other the appropriate greetings then as well.